Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And for this show, we're going to be more than creative. Creative is just the start. How creative can we be? What can we make of our lives? Well, to do a better job, we're going to interview the author of a book called Making Your Creative Mark. He's actually authored about 40 books at this point. And I love this book. I am definitely committed to it. So let's talk to the author, Eric Maisel. Eric, welcome.
Hi, Peter. How are you today?
Thanks. Thanks for being on the show.
You bet.
This is really exciting to talk about creativity. And I know that some of the book relates to artists. And I've been an artist. I was a professional photographer for 20 years. And that was a long time ago. And yet I still am creating in other ways, just in life. I just recently created a new healing program. And I relate to your book totally for that. So I really think this is so helpful in many, many ways. I took notes all the way through it. Those notes are going to be posted in my office, and I'll be using them for a long time because I think that you really know your stuff.
And, of course, as you say, it's not just about being an artist. Creativity is an interesting word, just the word itself. In business, it tends to mean problem-solving and innovation. But I think the rest of us more take it to mean manifesting our potential. It's the word I think we now use for the whole human potential movement. And so it encompasses anything, any place where we would want to manifest our potential.
Right. And that's why this book gets into so many ways that we need to manage our lives and ourselves to do a better job. And you have 9 keys for it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. As you mentioned, I've been writing about the creative life and the creative process for a long time. I've written books on creativity and depression, creativity and addiction, creativity and anxiety. So I don't shy away from the real issues that we face. And as I work with clients, these issues keep coming back. With each new client, I see the issues again. And so I started out with the mind key in the book because I really think it's the first key. The other 8 might come in any order, depending on the individual.
Right.
But we all have to do a better job of getting a grip on our mind and
right.
thinking thoughts that serve us and not getting in our own way. Folks are tremendously in their own way. And
you can't even get started until you get out of your way.
You can't even get started. And because creative people tend to be intelligent people, rational people sometimes, they get hooked on the idea that if they have a true thought, they have to countenance it. It's like they get held hostage to true thoughts. So what do I mean? Let's say you have a thought like, boy, there are a lot of writers out there, or boy, there are a lot of photographers out there. That's a true thought.
Right.
But it may not be a thought that serves you. You know, maybe you shouldn't be thinking, boy, there are a lot of photographers out there. That may stymie you. And what often happens is we have a thought like that on a Monday, and then on Wednesday, we stopped doing our work, and we don't even know what happened. And what happened was we had one of those stray, true thoughts, and we got sabotaged by it.
Although we do have to analyze whether we're in the right identity. We might think that we need to, you know, be a photographer, let's say, and yet other things seem to hold sway over us. And we realize that, well, I never had my heart in it as much as I expected to.
That's a great point. And, of course, you're speaking to one of the keys in the book, which is the identity key. If you intend to be a photographer, let's say, then you need to say out loud, so to speak, or literally out loud, I'm a photographer. Because if you don't wear that identity piece strongly, you probably won't get your work done. You were speaking to a different issue where maybe you don't really want to be a photographer and you want to shed that identity. And that's, of course, one kind of issue. But the more common issue that I see is that a person who actually is something, a writer, a painter, a photographer, can't wear that identity piece very comfortably. thinks of herself as an imposter or not there yet or something, in some way disparages herself and minimizes the identity piece. I was at a conference some time back, a writer's conference, and I did a keynote. And then the next day I sat in on the next person's keynote, and he asked a simple question, you know, who in the audience identifies as a writer? And there were 500 writers in the audience, and two people raised their hands, me and another person. You know, 498 writers couldn't quite get their hand up when asked if they were a writer. And that weakens them. That's a bad sign. If you can't, so to speak, raise your hand when you're asked, you know, am I a painter, am I a photographer, and you are one, that's going to cause you to not do your work over time.
And we can actually be a lot of things at the same time. We don't only have to be one thing.
We have to be a lot of things. And that's why our primary identity piece, I think, is human being. You know, we have to kind of step back and understand that we're a human being first with all of our, you know, quirks and, you know, being the experimental model of our own species. You know, we're a human being first, but then we need to decide which identity pieces we want to wear strongly and where we don't want to get hooked.
Right, and you talk about finding out how we're hardwired, you know, because those identities are the best suited for us when we're hardwired to them.
Yeah, and it's a very complicated business because we have no idea. Nobody knows. Astrologers claim to know, but nobody knows what our original personality really is. It's an interesting point because psychology has completely skipped over in the last 100 years of psychotherapy, completely skipped over the question of who were you born?
Well, actually, I'm an analyst for the Human Design System. And that's even more concise about our identity.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't come up with details that you should definitely be a painter or...
No, that's right. We can't know that. That's right. I don't think we could even dream up any research to get at it. You know, I think it's going to... That's one of the mysteries that we have to deal with. So given that we don't know what our original personality is, who maybe we were, so to speak, supposed to be, unquote, since we can't know that, I think all we can do is look at our passions and interests as meaning opportunities and try them out. And we can't quit on them too soon because all of these enterprises are pretty hard. You know, there's an apprenticeship. It takes some time to learn something. It's not so easy to write your first novel or, you know, compose your first symphony.
Well, this is why one of the keys is called the passion key.
That's right. And I think most people can't just white-knuckle creativity. They can't act like it's a matter of discipline. The work's a little too hard, really, to be just disciplined. I think we have to have some passion for the work, some enthusiasm for the work, some curiosity about the work, and maybe even, to raise the bar higher, be productively obsessed about the work, to care about it that much. Pavarotti has a quote. Oh, go ahead.
And also you discern the difference between discipline and devotion.
And that's what I was going to say, that Pavarotti has a quote I like, which is, people call me disciplined, and it's not discipline, it's devotion, and there's a big difference. And there is a big difference. If you were to look at him, you would know he was not disciplined in lots of areas of his life, but he was devoted to singing beautifully. And so discipline really isn't enough. If our interests are only mere interests, we probably won't do them. And I have tons of clients who come to me and say, I'm interested in 46 things and I can't do any of them. And that's because mere interest isn't enough. We have to kind of love what we're doing. And if the flame of desire has gone out over time, and it does, because real life wears us down, then I think we have to rekindle that flame ourselves. We have to figure out how to do that. And I think the way we do that best is to remember what we fell in love with when we were 5 and 6 and 7, you know, how we fell in love with reading or those big images on a screen in a darkened theater and what have you.
Or wanting to be a professional basketball player.
Or wanting to be a professional basketball player. And that one we kind of had to give up when we stopped growing after 5'5". Absolutely.
Right.
That's right.
My kids were like that.
That's right. So we need to rekindle that flame ourselves because it does go out. I mean, one of the dirty little secrets of the creative process is that if you're working on a novel, say, for 2 years, you know, for 300 of those days, you may be hating the book, you know, because you're slogging along and you're not really sure whether to, you know, send your character to Paris or to Zanzibar. You don't like your last paragraph. You know, we don't like our work a percentage of the time. And so we have to find the way to love it even when we hate it. And that's a tricky, the tricky line to walk, because we want to be honest in our appraisal that the work isn't, you know, turning out beautifully, but at the same time we want to be invested in it, committed to it, and passionate about it.
Well, actually, and as important as the passion key is, there are times when we're just not hot.
Lots of times.
Yeah, and then our identity gets kind of smudged from that, and we need to find the understandings of that hot and cold.
And we need to show up. I mean, that is probably the biggest small headline about the creative process, is we need to show up. Tchaikovsky said, every fifth day I'm inspired, but I don't get that fifth day if I don't work the other 4 days.
Right.
It's a huge point. You know, it's a real point, because, you know, if you're going to sit there in a kind of smiley-faced way saying, oh, it's all about inspiration, and as soon as the inspiration comes, I'll do my next thing, you won't do your next thing. It means you're not really honoring process. The process is showing up, trying as best as you can to not attach to the outcome, to just do the work and see what happens. You can't really attach to the outcome, because only a percentage of our work is going to turn out well. That's a hard truth to hear, but that's the case, that only, you know, 20% of our work, or 40% or 60%, whatever the percentage is for a given human being, only some of our work is going to turn out beautifully. The rest we have to put aside, discard.
I remember recently that Philip Roth quit writing because it was too painful for him.
Yeah, too much of it wasn't working may have been, you know, one of the reasons. And we can't skip the things that don't work. That's our secret wish, is nobody starts a project saying, well, maybe this will be one of the ones that don't work. Nobody does that. Everyone hopes that the thing they're starting will turn out excellently. And in a way, you have to let go of that desire. You want to invest in the work and have, you know, dreams for it and ambitions for it, while at the same time not needing it to work. It's a very mature and sophisticated attitude, but it's the attitude that allows you to end up with a body of work rather than just getting over-invested in the thing in front of you and work on the same, you know, memoir or song or what have you for the next 20 years.
Well, it's interesting to me how spontaneous life is and how we never know when we can't structure. We never know because things happen. I recently was inspired by this new healing program. I never thought of it before, and it just fell into my head walking out of an acupuncture session. And all of a sudden it was there, and I was kind of downloaded with this whole program. And it was kind of like it almost took me off my feet. And so that's an inspiration that happens. That's the muse at work. And you never know when that muse is going to show up.
No, but it probably won't show up if you're not interested in life, to return to the passion key. Something about, you know, healing, or however to say it, probably interests you in an ongoing way. It's an ongoing meaning opportunity for you. It's something that's meaningful to you. And so because you're holding it somewhere out of conscious awareness as something that interests you, to use my language, there's a meaning container that you've opened up somewhere in your being, such that there's a possibility of inspiration coming. If we're not interested in things, I think those kinds of inspirations, the one you just described, just doesn't come to us.
Well, if it does, it's very, very rare, so we shouldn't expect it.
Mm-hmm. That's right. We have to keep showing up, doing our work, working on Project A, and if Project Q suddenly enters our consciousness, we need to know how to jot it down, or, you know, or turn to it if it requires our attention. We need to know how to have that kind of flawless transmission system where we can be working on A, but if Q comes, we can turn to Q.
So a lot of what we're talking about here is developing the confidence in our identity through getting our mind out of the way.
That's right.
And you have keys for all of that.
Right, and you mentioned the confidence key. Many creative people, because they have to have a day job or a second career, they often sort of look confident in their day job and their second career, because in a certain sense it matters much less than their creative life. And so it always surprises them when they turn to their creative work, when they have to query a literary agent or something like that, that their confidence evaporates, that suddenly they're so much more anxious than they were the moment before. And it seems to continually surprise them how their confidence sort of drains away. But it's not really surprising, because we're typically less confident where things matter to us. Or to put it differently, we get more anxious where things matter to us. So maybe, you know, at work we can spend $2 million of our company's budget without blinking, because we don't really care in a certain sense. But then we get home and we try to work on our poem, and suddenly we're super anxious and not confident at all. So we just have to remember that connection, that where things matter, we get less confident.
Right. And you talk about relationships, and in what you're saying, I'm thinking of, for instance, when you look at the art world, there are a lot of artists out there that are wonderful artists, but they're humble people, and they're somewhat insecure, let's say, in how to present themselves. And yet there are so many artists who have very large egos and can dominate.
That's right. They'll do better. That's right.
Right. And yet it doesn't mean that their art is better.
No, that's right. It means that they're assertive or aggressive with respect to the marketplace. And I have to tell all my clients, you know, all my readers, that they too have to be assertive and aggressive with respect to the marketplace, even if it isn't, so to speak, a personality part of them. They have to do it. And the way that I frame it to them is not you have to become a salesperson or a marketer or a promoter, but you need to befriend your work. You need to be the advocate for your work, because who else really is going to be? And creative people, you know, spend a lifetime looking for somebody else to advocate for them, that literary agent or that, you know, that intermediary, that gatekeeper who can do the work for them. And typically, we have to do it ourselves. And to make another point, we have to prove the exception. The rule is creative people are not going to be successful financially in the marketplace. That's the rule, unfortunately. 99% of creative folks won't make a living from the marketplace. Well, you want to be in the 1%, don't you? And to do that, you have to prove the exception. If everybody is doing X, you need to try your hand at Y, because X isn't enough. X isn't good enough.
Well, you also spend a lot of time in the book talking and teaching about interpersonal skills. And it's really important to understand ourselves in relationship to the marketplace.
That's right.
And know how to work with it better, being able to analyze our shortcomings and our strengths, and even the shortcomings and strengths of other people in the marketplace, and being able to empathize.
That's exactly right. And for me, the empathy key, empathy has a kind of a ring of compassion about it, but I think that at its basic, it's not about compassion, but just about understanding other human beings and being able to get in their shoes. And typically, not always, but typically, creative folks don't want to think about the realities of the people they're dealing with, literary agents, audience members, whomever. They don't want to think about that. But that puts them at a disadvantage. If you were willing to think about, let's just take a simple example. If you could picture that a literary agent is getting hundreds of emails a day and has to delete most of them quickly so as to get on with the ones that really interest her, that will instantly clue you into the fact that you better have a super special subject line to your email, or else you're going to be one of the deleted ones. And suddenly you've just learned something for yourself about the marketplace, namely, my query email needs an interesting subject line. And that's a straightforward point. And yet if you're not thinking about this literary agent with all of these emails coming in and needing to delete so many of them, you might do that boring subject line yourself, you know, please look at my, you know, please represent me, and that would get instantly deleted. So by understanding the pressures on marketplace players, you set yourself up for knowing how to deal with them better.
Right, and being able to empathize with them. How might they be thinking? What would their priorities be? What if I was in their shoes?
That's right. What do they need from me? That's right. What are they looking for? What do they need from me? How can I massage what I do so it meets what they're looking for? All of those things are really important skills.
That's a big job. That's a big part of the job.
It is a big part of the job. And as I say, most creative people don't want to do that part. They would love to be allowed to, you know, stay in the studio and work and then, you know, turn the work over to somebody else. But more and more frequently, we are obliged to do the marketing and promoting piece.
Well, you also talk about how many different stresses there are, and you list them and go through them. There are so many in life, and this is true for everybody, not just
all
artists.
All human beings.
All human beings are stressed by a common number of stressors that you list. It doesn't matter what profession you're in.
No, there are economic stresses. There are relationship stresses. There, if you dare to look at the news, there are world stresses. And there are the existential stressors of, you know, knowing that you will die one day, knowing that this is your time on Earth. And there are all kinds of psychological stressors, all kinds, having to do with, you know, early childhood and current relationships and what have you. So, yeah, everybody experiences stress. Mm-hmm. And stress is different from anxiety. Anxiety happens in the moment, and you need anxiety management tools for the anxiety that happens in the moment. Stress builds up over time. It's an important point. It builds up in the system. It builds up chemically, hormonally, in the system. And so it's going to be naturally the case that if you're working on a novel, as you try to complete it, the stress of having worked on it for 2 years has been building up. All the difficulties associated with it have been building up. And so not only do you have the natural difficulty of trying to complete a thing and knowing how to complete it, but you have all of this chemical stress in your body at the same time. So artists, all human beings, need to learn how to reduce their stress in simple ways and complicated ways, but however they do it. And creative people need especially to learn how to deal with the most natural stressors that they're going to face, things like figuring out how to complete things and figuring out how to deal in the marketplace, the economic and marketplace stressors maybe especially.
Well, I think what it is that these stressors that you're talking about are things that you can define and make sense of, whereas anxiety is just a feeling that's hard to define. It's there because there's pressure.
It's there because your warning system of danger has been engaged. That's why it's there. And we don't do a beautiful job of understanding what's dangerous. You know, the creative life, the creative process is making one choice after another. That's what it is. Put a little red in, take a little red out. Put the comma in, take the comma out. It's one choice after another. And choosing provokes anxiety because our system feels like the next choice we make is somehow dangerous. Somehow dangerous whether to put the comma in or take the comma out. So we can help ourselves there in a dramatic large way by trying to talk ourselves down from the sense of danger associated with things like putting a little red in or taking a little red out. We can, so to speak, throw a switch and become a calmer person by reminding ourselves that these things are not dangerous like tigers coming at us.
Or
not that kind of danger.
Or we can do more work on the computer that erases easier.
That's exactly right.
It's harder to erase on a canvas. And I remember the old days working with electric typewriters. I wrote a book on an electric typewriter and all that whiteout that you had to use anytime.
Whiteout, and you know, I'm from the whiteout and carbon paper. I think I still have carbon on my fingers from carbon paper.
So those
30 years ago.
Right, and those caused a lot of anxiety.
I can't even think any longer about how it could have been the case that I would retype whole manuscripts to change a few words. It's quite wacky because I've been writing for more than 40 years now, and I had a ghostwriting career in my 20s where I would turn out a book in a month on any subject you would tell me. So that was a lot of typing and a lot of whiteout and a lot of and a lot of carbon paper.
Right. And so what's fascinating, we only have a few minutes left, and I'm so fascinated not only by the quality of your book, but just the way your mind works, that you really cover the gamut. You know, there's so much in here that's food for thought and to take action from too, that I'm so excited about knowing all this information now. I have lists from your books that I'm going to be posting. I'm probably going to use my computer and type them in, because these are handwritten now.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to keep track of all of these reminders on
mm-hmm.
how to do a better job. You know, how to be more of whoever I choose to be.
That's right. In a given moment. That's right. Whichever identity you want to wear today.
Exactly. And it's fun, and that's what a big part of this is. You bring a lot of fresh ideas and key ideas into play so that we can work with them and help ourselves.
Right. And a lot of simple practical things. I mean, it may not be so simple for a person to start to institute a morning creativity practice, but it's a simple idea to understand, and the value is tremendous. So there are ideas that are really simple to understand. Of course, you then have to implement them. But if you do, it'll change your creative life.
So Eric Maisel, M-A-I-S-E-L, your book is Making Your Creative Mark, 9 Keys to Achieving Your Artistic Goals. Well, let's call life artistic.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to thank you so much for your work and this book, because it's exciting to know you and to read your work and to be enhanced by it. So I want to thank you. And thank you so much for being a guest on Energy Stew.
You're very welcome. Thanks.
Thank you. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. And I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org, or 212-222-7748. Lots going on in New York. There's classes. And get in touch. Be glad to hear from you. And thank you so much for listening.